in a minute. So the spirit of the talk is mainly I view anything in quantum gravity as completely tentative and a model. So since I work in quantum gravity, you have to keep sane. And so whenever I'm stuck, I think about this, which is a famous poet from Persia in the 14th century. He says, don't despair, as you can see. Keep trying. And so that's what we're all doing here. So here's the outline. The first part is a review of the problem of time in quantum gravity. Edward Anderson talked about this, so this will cover some of the things he's already said, but in brief, and in particular, focus on the things that are relevant to my talk. And there are many other facets of the problem of time I won't say anything about. I'll give an outline of the canonical approach to quantization and point out what the state of the art is. So by canonical quantum gravity, I mean the old Wheeler-DeWitt program and its various incarnations, including the current metric connection incarnation of that. And so I'll hope to point out what the progress is and where it is that we want to go in order to see if we can finish this program and what the obstacles are and basically where it's stuck at this stage. Then what I'll do is I'll talk about a model for quantum gravity with emphasis on model because it's got some features which, from what I've heard over the last few days, there are many things people will disagree with as a starting point. But nevertheless, I view this model as something which is more or less complete and something ready to compute with. So I'll first describe the quantum theory and then the canonical quantization of it. And then there are lots of open problems. Whenever you have a model, you want to ask how many things you can do with it. And so so I'll list a few questions, and there are probably many more. This has almost nothing to do with conformal invariance, although there might be some reduction of the model, which has some type of conformal invariance, which I haven't really thought about very carefully. What it does have in common with other talks is a preferred time foliation. So let me begin with the problem of time in QG. So I'm going to think in terms of the 3 plus 1 ADM action. So there's the extrinsic ADM momentum, spatial metric Q, some matter, it doesn't need to be a scalar field, Hamiltonian constraint, diffeomorphism constraint. And the source of the problem of time is really the fact that we have a Hamiltonian constraint. And we think of the Hamiltonian constraint translated into the Dirac quantization program. The Dirac quantization program essentially says convert H into an operator, pick some space on which this operator lives, and then try to solve this equation. So there are various problems with even refining this question properly. So among the things you want to ask is, what is exactly the Hilbert space in which this wave function lives? How do you define this operator H? Is there more than one way to do it? Or are there multiple ways? Then there's a choice. How do you define some H regulators such that this action means something? And then ultimately ask, how do you get to the physical Hilbert space? And once you get there, then you want to ask, what do you do once you get to the physical Hilbert space? So it's easy enough to write this down, and but that doesn't do anything for you. So I'm going to put solutions in quotes. And this is, as I said, just a few facets of what Edward said earlier. So I'm going to think in terms of two pieces. So we've got a problem of time. We've got a gauge freedom. So let's just fix the gauge. What happens? So you can either fix the gauge completely, which means fix all the coordinates and time, or you can just say, I'm going to leave the coordinates alone and just fix the time. So essentially, pick a foliation is what this is saying. And I refer to this as reduced phase-based quantization, partially if you only do the time and fully if you do everything. If you do everything, it's full deparameterization. And so here, I put EG this, but I should really say this in quotes because they're not explicitly going into some big theory and fixing the time gauge. The theory is formulated such that there's a preferred foliation in both these cases. On the other hand, from my perspective, I want to start with a theory with full time reparametrization invariance, So this EG is sort of just an analogy. Okay. So what are the problems with just fixing a time gauge? The first problem, obvious problem, is there's no canonical choice. You can do whatever you want. And when you do whatever you want, there are all kinds of problems. So two of them are here. Generically, if you pick a time gauge, the form of the Hamiltonian, which is the phase space function conjugate to the time choice you picked, is a horrible mess. And typically, it'll involve a square root, mainly because, well, I'll give an example. But essentially, the form of the Hamiltonian is extremely complicated classically after you fix a time gauge. And if you can actually solve for the conjugate phase space variable to the time gauge, it's a horrible mess generically. And so even if you can do it classically, the next problem is how do you write it as an operator on your chosen Hilbert space to set up the Dirac quantization problem? So first stage is to set up the Dirac quantization problem. And then once you succeed in all this, if you do, then there are different choices of the Hamiltonian if you can write as an operator, which lead to unitarily inequivalent quantum theories. And so you're stuck again and you don't know what to do. Yes?
Is that last line really a problem or is it a feature?
Oh, I see. Is it a bug or a feature? It could be viewed as a feature and say, yes, you have many choices and you go to experiment and you could decide what to do. I suppose, yeah, maybe it's not a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it would be nice if... So the other approach is do not fix time gauge. And this is what's normally called Dirac quantization, where the Wheeler-DeWitt equation comes from. And so ultimately, you want to deal with time in some way. So you want to ask, OK, how do you get time out of this? So there are various schemes that people have played with. There's emergent time, which is really a notion that somehow time arises in the infrared. And you shouldn't ask this question in the fundamental theory at all. And it could be a WKB or some other mechanism where you take the Hamiltonian constraint and somehow separate fast and slow degrees of freedom, do something like Born-Oppenheimer with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and see if something pops out. Relational time, which is you think of just correlations between observables, take the Hamiltonian constraint seriously and say that the only thing the Hamiltonian constraint can give you is some balancing between some observables and some other observables, and you want to track that through, presumably, starting at the quantum level and then arriving at a semi-classical description of these correlations that make sense. In fact, there's something compelling about this because this is normally what we do when we measure time. So if time is to emerge from any scheme like this, then it has to be relational in some sense and not really what I'm going to talk about, but there it is. Then the other possible way to find a solution to the problem of time is if you can get to a Hamiltonian constraint that is linear in one of the momenta that describe your theory. This will allow you to write down a functional Schrodinger equation with many finger time, and then you can fix time gauge and get a true time if you like. The problem with this is that if you're just doing pure GR, then there's a proof by Torrey that there's no canonical transformation on the Qs and Pis that will take your Hamiltonian constraint and produce a new one with canonical transformation that's linear in one momentum. So this is a dead end if you're just doing pure GR. It may not be a dead end if you add matter, which is what I'm going to talk about. So in this talk here, I'm just going to take the first approach and not look at the geometrical variables to find the time because of that reason I just said, but try to find some type of matter time.
Is there a simple reason that canonical transformation doesn't work?
Oh, it's a technical thing. So if you just take a free particle, you can parameterize the particle. If you take any theory with a kinetic term, which is quadratic in momenta, yeah, you can always parameterize it. Then the Hamiltonian constraint that arises from that fake parameterization is always linear in the momenta. So the question being asked here is general relativity already a parameterized theory? And the answer seems to be no. Okay. So here's the outline after this preamble. So this is the next part of my talk. If you want to follow this non-perturbative QG approach, what are the problems that you need to deal with? So the first thing you need to deal with is you want to define something which is a kinematical Hilbert space. The kinematical Hilbert space is just designed to set up the Wheeler-DeWitt quantization program. You need to say, here's my configuration space, whatever it is, whatever the coordinates on it. Here's the wave functions. Here's the function space. Here's the operator. And so that space has got nothing to do with physical states. It's simply, it's called H-kin for H-kinematical. You presumably want to solve the constraints and find the kinematical Hilbert space from that. Then you want to, once you've got that, you want to just find the constraints and the operators on H-kin. Ideally, what you want to do is you want to check the algebra of the constraint operators. This is, since your constraints generate first-class transformations, you want an anomaly-free theory. You want to make sure that all the operators you have that represent your gauge transformations at the operator level, that algebra is closed. Okay? Without that, you can't really go anywhere because there are anomalies. Then comes step four. There, you can think of mini steps in between these, but for me, these are the primary steps here. Find the phase space, find the space of solution of the constraints, and this will give you a physical Hilbert space. Once you're there, then you can start doing physics. But until you've got up to step four, you can't really talk about doing serious physics. Okay, that's my view of this. Okay, so let me then come to what the state of the art is. And as I said, there's a second incarnation of the whole DeWitt program, which is in terms of canonical variables introduced by Ashtekar and later put into a real form by Barbero. So they're called Ashtekar-Barbero variables. So the state of the art in loop quantum gravity, as far as I can tell, is you've got one, you've got two, you've got some solutions of the constraints that also satisfy this condition. H is the Hamiltonian constraint. In other words, if you write this operator H out, and there's a prescription to do it provided by Piemann, then what happens is, yes, H on psi is zero for some classes of psi, but when you compute H with H, you get a horrible operator. That horrible operator just happens to kill those solutions you found. Sorry? So the horrible operator is this commutator. So when you compute this, it does not close on the spatial diffeomorphisms, at least as far as I know, unless there's a new development in the last week or so. Okay. So in a sense, people have argued that this is a fundamental problem. Others have argued that it's not. But anyway, that's sort of the state of the art. Then I should say something about semi-classical states and physical observables. There are observables people have defined on H-kin and semi-classical states people have defined on H-kin, which are called kinematical observables and kinematical semi-classical states. And there's been some work using those states to see if something can be extracted. But they're not physical semi-classical states. Okay, so that's part of the state of the art. Now, let me just point out that solving H psi, even after you have H kin, and you can write down the Wheeler-DeWitt operator down properly, regulated, and so on, you may still have a problem in solving H psi equals zero. And here's a little example that illustrates why it may not have any solutions. Sort of a trivial little example. Suppose you take two harmonic oscillators and impose a fake constraint, energy of oscillator one plus energy of oscillator two is some constant. So the obvious choice for H-kin is just the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces, M and N, two integers. And then you write down your Dirac quantization condition. There it is with some general linear combination of the states like that. Now, this can have solutions provided your C is a very special number. In particular, C has to be, you know, whatever, this thing has to vanish because you've got a complete set of states. So for example, if C is pi, there are no solutions, all right, and so on. So you have to be very careful, even if you have H-kin, whether that's actually going to help you. So what's the route is taken in loop quantum gravity is you want to say that there's a dual space to your kinematical Hilbert space. That dual space is much bigger. And so you want to ask a different question. The solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint are really, you should think about them in terms of solving this equation where this dual space is not isomorphic to your H-kin. Okay, so anyway, all I want to point out with that little example is that the physical Hilbert space problem is very difficult. Okay. Okay, so let me now turn to the model. And what I intend to show you in this model is that you can solve all these problems. And you can solve them with perhaps what you might call a little sleight of hand, but it's actually a legitimate theory. Okay? So here's a theory. It's Einstein gravity plus whatever matter action you want to throw in, plus this pressureless dust. So the fields in the theory, so this pressureless dust is such that this field T is constrained to be time-like. G is a Lorentzian metric. Everything is Lorentzian here. And we've got
Can I just check? That's something you're imposing on top of what physics would give you.
No, this is the definition of the theory.
Yeah.
This is the definition of the theory. Mm-hmm. So if you like, you know, you're questioning why I'm defining this, but it's really, I'm defining it because it gives me something and solves some problems.
Yeah, I mean, if I had dust floating around in the universe.
There is dust floating around. There is dust floating around in the universe.
Yeah, and would it behave as you're imposing here?
Well, that I don't know.
Would it provide the field that you need?
I don't know that. That's an experimental question. Here, this is, I'm just viewing this as a model, and it's going to, we'll just see where it goes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
This is a special kind of dust, or is there some kind of physics does it
have? You'll see slowly, yes. I mean, you can see the stress energy tensor is this. So it's really, you can see what it is from there. It's a pressureless dust. Mm-hmm. So on the constraint surface, TAB is just some mass density times UAUB. Okay, very dilute light dust.
So, to a good approximation, galaxies.
I don't know.
Cosmology to treat galaxies.
Yes. So it's just basically a really weak dust, no pressure, and it's just everywhere filling the universe. So there's a stress energy tensor. Now, there's a long history of dust, and so there's a dust action introduced by Brown and Kukoc, which has some really interesting canonical features, which came out in around 95. It's a dust which has not one scalar field, but four scalar fields. The action is rigged up to provide a simplification at the canonical level, and the simplification is really quite amazing. What it does is, with the four scalar fields, that is, the basic result of Brown and Kukoc with four dust fields, not this action, but a different one, maybe I should have put it up, is that they can do a canonical theory where they find a new Hamiltonian constraint. And the new Hamiltonian constraint commutes with itself, and the diffeomorphism constraint is just sitting there by itself. And so we don't have the problem with the usual Dirac constraint algebra of the Hamiltonian constraint with itself is that the right-hand side has structure functions that depend on configuration variable Q. So this Brown-Kukoc mechanism avoids that problem. However, the problem, why can't we then just push this and do quantum gravity, non-canonical quantum gravity? The problem is that the Hamiltonian that they do get is messy. It's got a square root in it. So you can't really go and say, right, I've got H, and I'm going to define the operator and go and proceed. In fact, this was tried by a few people working in loop quantum gravity, Thomas Thiemann and others. And they did end up with a horrible square root Hamiltonian, and that's hard to deal with. Now, the other comment about this kind of action is there's a long history in spherical symmetry. This gives the class of Tolman-Bondi-Lemaitre models. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just tell you the Hamiltonian theory, which is really very simple. All you do is we know the Hamiltonian theory of the GR part and all the other matter you want to put in, so this is the only thing we want to focus on. And then add it to the GR canonical theory in the ADM variables. So just take the ADM split, which you've seen many times, plug it into the dust action. This is the dust Lagrangian that follows from what I had up here. That's this thing here. And this is what you get. You define the canonical momentum, plug it back in. You get the dust action in Hamiltonian form. It's got PT, T dot. PT is the conjugate momentum defined just here. You've got the contribution to the Hamiltonian constraint multiplied by the lapse. You've got the contribution to the Diffeo constraint multiplied by the shift. Okay. So what does HD look like? It looks like this. Notice that it depends on Q. It does not depend on pi, the conjugate to Q, and it shouldn't. It depends on M, and there it is. And you can see that it's rather unpleasant looking at this stage. It still depends on M, and this is the diffeomorphism constraint. So where do you go from here? Well, what you do is you simply write down the equation of motion from the dust action, plug it back in, and you get rid of this Lagrange multiplier M that way. There's M, a very simple calculation. And so the dust action is now this. You'll notice the square root Hamiltonian. Okay, and the square root Hamiltonian has got pt squared. The ca here is just the generator of the spatial diffeo. And there's a spatial diffeo there. And so if I want to do Dirac quantization with this using this procedure I outlined, it's easy to define these operators on some kinematical Hilbert space, but it's hard to define this operator on that kinematical Hilbert space, mainly because the algebra of this with this has got square roots, and you know it's hard to define this operator, square root operator. Basically, PT does not commute with CAD, okay, which is the dust contribution to the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, so.
So this M is not the M in the matter. Is it just an unfortunate notation in HM?
So this M here?
Yes.
This M was a Lagrange multiplier. So I've got the canonical action now, and I'm solving the equation of motion for M and plugging it back in. Yeah. So now the final dust action, final full action, has got no M in it. Yeah, just only the canonical variables.
So again, this distinction between the two formulations with the square root before is very much like the difference between the number of the action
yes.
and the
final
action. Isn't it better to then keep M around?
You'll see why I don't want to keep M around. Yeah, you'll see that. So now here's the final canonical theory. We've got the Qs and Pis from ADM. We've got the T and PT of the dust, and we've got the phi and P phi, which is whatever matter you want, not necessarily a scalar field. We've got the constraints, H gravity contribution to the Hamiltonian constraint, dust, and the rest of your matter, and the same three contributions to your diffeo constraint. So that's the canonical theory. Okay, so now I come to the special foliation. Now, as I already said, Dirac quantization in the form that I had here is difficult. Whether you use spin connection variables or whether you use ADM variables. And so now I'm going to pick a gauge. This is a special foliation. I'm simply going to take the dust field, a configuration field as time. You can check that this is second class with the Hamiltonian constraint. In fact, if you want to preserve this gauge under time evolution, you simply do t dot is little t dot, which is 1, which is this. And then you calculate this. After you calculate the bracket, you let big T equals little t. Okay, that's the usual procedure. And normally what this procedure does is if you just fix a time gauge and it isn't this kind of matter, some other system, typically this gives you a relation between the lapse and the shift. Okay, it does not give you a decoupling of the lapse and shift. But here what we find is with this gauge, there's a decoupling of the lapse and shift. This fixes n equals 1 and leaves the shift arbitrary. Okay, that's the main point here, and in this sense, it's very similar to the other models we've seen here in this meeting. So now what happens is, if big T is, little t is a time gauge, the physical Hamiltonian is minus the momentum conjugate to that big T. Here it is, and so you can define this is the physical Hamiltonian, and the physical Hamiltonian is nothing but the gravitational part of the Hamiltonian constraint, which is no longer a constraint, plus the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint, and these two things are no longer constrained to vanish. It is a solution of the strong solution of the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay? So we've got a physical Hamiltonian. Now, important features of the physical Hamiltonian is there is no square root. What was the constraint is now the physical Hamiltonian. Okay, that's the main point here. Yes.
So this choice n equals 1 is typically not globally reachable, though, right? I mean, if you have a classical solution, it's not an accessible gauge.
The thing is, classical solution of what? So here we've got a remaining gravity theory.
Right.
The gauge is external, so T is some now external T. And so if you're asking the question, suppose now I have some metric. Can I take any metric and write it in this form? The answer is no. So if you like...
asking more specifically is that if you take this theory as a classical theory with some reasonable additional form of matter and find solutions, do solutions generically admit this gauge? And I would think typically not, because typically you're going to have situations where your matter collapses to form black holes and then you get breakdowns.
You might, yes, you might get breakdowns. So locally, of course, there's no problem. So you're asking globally, can I do this? So here I'm only addressing the local issue. So in a sense, it's similar to shape dynamics versus global.
Yeah, this is certainly no worse than many other things.
But I mean, yes, the payoff is not really in looking at classical. So the payoff is it's a complete model of quantum gravity. And of course, it'll still have to face classical limits if we can actually do some computations.
Yeah.
Okay. I should be touching this. Hello. Oops. And the other feature is that this is independent of time. Otherwise, we couldn't have done this anyway. If the rest of the terms here depended on T and PT in the original Hamiltonian constraint, this wouldn't have happened. Okay, so what becomes of one of the questions you want to ask is what becomes of local Lorentz invariance, because that's a question that arises when you fix a preferred foliation. And the answer is nothing. The reason is that if I now look at the gauge fixed action, here's the gauge fixed action, pq dot p phi phi dot minus ag minus h phi this. And all you need to do is, the first thing that happens in this is there's one more local degree of freedom in the gravity variables since the matter time gauge was used. Okay, that's important to keep in mind. So that is going to affect whatever background dependent expansion you do. The other thing is the matter field equations are just Lorentz invariant for any usual form of H phi. Simply work out, put in the H phi for the scalar field. You will get phi double dot plus phi double prime is zero, grad phi squared. So there's local Lorentz invariance. And the same holds for any other matter you put in unless the Hamiltonian explicitly breaks it. So the gauge is not doing that for you here. So now the quantization, how are we going to proceed with the quantization? Well, the basic idea is going to borrow a lot of things, which are the parts of LQG just very clean and established. Use the Ashtekar-Barbero canonical variables for gravity for the gravity sector. Use the loop quantum gravity kinematical Hilbert space, which is a spin network basis. I'll say a little bit more about this in detail because people aren't experts here. One of the features of H-kin, and I'll talk about this in a slight bit more detail, H-kin carries a representation of the spatial diffeomorphism group, and you can compare this to usual QFT Hilbert space, which carries a representation of the Poincaré group. Okay. Yes?
There is this caveat that it carries only a unitary representation and it's not continuous and like.
That's right. Oh, yeah, there's that caveat. So essentially, the representation is such that it carries finite diffeomorphisms, and you cannot get the generators back from the generators of diffeo back. So it's not really Dirac quantization of the diffeos that's going on. Yes, thanks for pointing. Then the other thing is there's at least one construction of the formerly the Hamiltonian constraint, now the physical Hamiltonian available on H-kin due to Piemann's work a while back. But in the theory we're talking about, this Hamiltonian is in fact the physical Hamiltonian. And this H-kin can be viewed as the physical Hilbert space because there's no Dirac quantization condition to solve for anymore. Okay, so let me just briefly summarize known stuff about H-kin. In this formulation, what you have is because it's a Fehrbein formulation ultimately with the self-dual connection, it contains an extra constraint, which is the Gauss law constraint. And the Gauss law constraint is in addition to the Hamiltonian constraint and the Diffeo constraint. This is the starting point where loops enter the picture because the idea is that now you can move to a connection representation and you want functions of essentially holonomies of the connection because they transform nicely under the Gauss law. And you want to think of functions of holonomies associated with curves gamma and the holonomy is constructed in some representation J. So in other words, just construct SU2 matrices using the holonomy, and they're labeled by the representation in which you did it and by the embedded curves in your spatial manifold. We're doing canonical quantizations, so you have the spatial manifold. Okay, so you want to look at functions of this type. That's these are the functions that are going to be used to form the Hilbert space, this kinematical Hilbert space. So the spin network states are basically, what you want to do is you want this object to be gauge invariant. So the U's have matrix indices, you want to eat them all up. So you introduce another variable, which are called the holonomy, or which is called the intertwiner. So you do some tracing, and for example, this is one typical spin network state, and this tying up with this I is nothing but a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. Okay. And so, in a sense, if you want to write, and there's a, the inner product is just, you have copies of SU2, because each U is an SU2 matrix. You've got a natural measure, which is the Haar measure. The important thing about this inner product is that it does not depend on the phase space variables. It does not depend on E and pi, otherwise it would be background dependent. So you can think of this state as just the collection of graphs is a collection of curves, let's call it a graph. It's labeled by angular momentum J1 to Jn, and it's labeled by these intertwiners, which sit at vertices of the graph, which are used to tie up all the free indices. Okay, so this is a gauge invariant spin network state, heuristically speaking. Okay, now three diffeomorphism invariant states, and I'll just give the intuitive idea here, and you can look up the details. They're available in many places. There's a natural action of finite diffeos on these states. And the basic intuition is, again, very simple. Diffeos move the graph, but do not affect the representations or the intertwiners. So if I want to find the diffeomorphism invariant state, the diffeomorphism just drag the graph around the surface. So I simply erase the graph, and there's my diffeomorphism invariant state. Okay, so it's easy, and it's clean, and you can dress it up in all kinds of mathematical detail if you're so inclined.
So where is this SU2 coming from?
Sorry?
What is this SU2?
Oh, the SU2. So the SU2 is coming essentially because of the original connection triad variables for gravity. So these new phase space variables here, I should have perhaps sat here for a bit. This I is an SU2 index, and the A is a spatial index. And these are the new canonical variables, or now relatively old canonical variables for GR introduced by Ashtekar. So they rewrite their combinations of... they can be written as, so instead of the spatial metric, you write it as a dribine. And the Ashtekar connection here, A, is a combination of the spin connection and the extrinsic curvature.
Would that be SL2
SU2? So there was a long discussion about this in the 90s. So the action is you can think of the action as an SO3-1 action, and you can break it up into the self-dual and the anti-self-dual parts. That's a complex connection. So if you work from there, then this A is actually complex. But then there was a development, and so the advantage of this complex connection is that the Hamiltonian constraint was very simple and polynomial. Then nobody could do the quantum theory because you had to impose some reality conditions on that. So what happened is that instead of the I in the self-dual, anti-self-dual projection of SO3-1, a parameter was put there called gamma. And that gamma renders everything real, and it's a different decomposition coming from a different action known as a Holst action. And it gives the, it gives actually just SU2s. Oops.
Grounds, if you have SO3-1, I don't think you can get the real section with SU2.
No. So that's been discussed in the literature as well. So this is happening at the at strictly the canonical level. And so the question has been raised whether, and discussed in the literature, whether this real connection really comes from a projection of a four-dimensional connection. But nevertheless, at the canonical level, this is relatively straightforward.
It does, actually. That's the part of the point of the recent work that I've done with Stefan Kiewan. So we have a paper showing how these SU2 variables fit neatly into the space-time variables. I can talk to you about it later.
Oh, I was thinking of the papers by Joseph Samuel, who pointed out that there's no projection. But maybe this, I should look at this.
So, what is the big part of this theory argument? There is no real section of what's the loophole on that? Is there, let's say, one line, a complicated?
So the point is, I don't want to derail this discussion, so maybe we should talk about it.
Okay. So here's a picture of one of these things. So essentially the idea is, again, just to reiterate the idea, you've got these edges which are labeled by SU2 representations. You've got the vertices where edges come together, and you have to tie up all the matrix indices there. So that's really, give me one of these and you have a kinematical Hilbert space state, well-defined inner product. Okay. Now, a Hamiltonian operator, if I'm working in this a connection triad representation, the physical Hamiltonian density is relatively horrible looking. This gamma is a parameter called the immersive parameter, which ultimately comes from the action that's being used. So the problem here is, now can we convert this into an operator? So there's one choice, and I'll quickly run through that choice. The one that's mainly used these days. But there are other possibilities that have been discussed in the literature, and this one is due to Thiemann. So essentially what you do is you imagine a triangulation of your spatial manifold. In the triangulation, you have, just think of tetrahedra, you have edges and you have vertices. So you have these eyes sitting at the vertices, and you have the edges labeled by these SU2 spins. And so give me a graph, gamma, then I can write the Hamiltonian as this. This is a Hamiltonian density. The classical Hamiltonian is the integral of this. Replace the integral by a sum over this triangulation, and you've got this piece. This piece is made up of various pieces. One of them is a volume operator. One of them is a combination of holonomy operators and another kind of holonomy operator. Anyway, this is well-defined. I don't want to dwell on this too much. The only point I want to make here is that there is one way to write this Hamiltonian, physical Hamiltonian of this dust model, which is very clean. Okay. So the main point is this. Absolutely, yeah. But the advantage, so that poses a special problem if you want to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But here we don't need to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Yeah. So in a sense, you can compare this to putting the Young-Mills Hamiltonian on a lattice, but that lattice is supposed to be a background, but here there's no background.
What is the physics then of the choice?
So at the moment, I don't think I can give you a good answer to the physics of the choice. Yes. Yeah.
So you don't care, or you don't?
I don't know the physics of various triangulations. Yeah. Yes. Not that I don't care.
Yes.
So anyway, it's got some pieces which are diagonal and some pieces which change the spin labels on the edges. Okay, so it's sort of a combinatorial rule that it provides how to upgrade these labels on these graphs. And actually, again, I'm just glossing over a whole bunch of stuff here, but just wanted to paint the larger picture. So summary so far is the structure that I've described provides a model for non-perturbative QG. It can be viewed as one possible completion of the LQG program. And the reason I say one possible completion is the main objection might be dust being used. There might be other objections. Nevertheless, it solves the physical Hilbert space problem, and it solves the problem of time. And that's where this program had been stalled for more than a decade. So. Now, there's no gauge anomaly because normally the gauge anomaly is an anomaly in the gauge in the operators that generate the gauge transformations. Here we don't have them, n is 1, and the Hamiltonian constraint is the physical Hamiltonian, so that's out of the way. Okay. So we've got a physical Hilbert space, we've got the Hamiltonian, at least one Hamiltonian operator, and we're working with other options. There are some observables which you probably heard about, area and volume and so on. Here there are physical observables, there were kinematical observables. There were semi-classical states before, which were kinematical semi-classical states. Here, they become physical semi-classical states. So in a sense, all the pieces are together, and I had to do relatively little work except to put in the dust, really, because all the other stuff was available and borrowed. Lastly, matter couplings are immediate. I can just take any matter term and add it to HFIZ, and all I need to do is find a way to write the corresponding Hamiltonian operator, which is not that simple, but there are some prescriptions floating around to do that. Okay, so there are lots of open problems. So how do I view all this? I basically view this as a test bed for some physical and technical problems. I'm not claiming this is the quantum theory of gravity. I can't do that. I don't think anybody can do that. So it's just a model like many other models, and it's just that there's a way to actually do physical computations if you sort of are careful about what you're doing. So among the questions are there other ways to write the Hamiltonian operator, H hat on the space of diffeomorphism invariant states? The Thiemann Hamiltonian was not written on the space of diffeomorphism invariant states. It was written on H-kin. So we have to rethink this. Then what do reduced models look like? And I mentioned at the end of Shinji's talk, one of the things that interests me a lot is spherical symmetry scalar field. We want to know, so the Chopra collapse results are can't hold in a quantum theory of gravity because there's this discrete self-similarity down to arbitrary small scales at the onset of black hole formation, and black holes form with arbitrary small mass. And if you've got a Planck scale in the problem, that probably is not going to happen. So something has to give. GR is not valid down to those fine scales. So this is an important question. You can ask it in Hojava-Lifshitz gravity. You can ask it in any other. And it's important to ask that question here. Just do spherical symmetry and ask how you're actually going to do this in the quantum theory, perhaps with physical semi-classical states. So here, this is this third point here. What is the black hole in quantum gravity is related to what you're actually going to see if you actually reduce this model to spherical symmetry and ask, well, what are you going to look for? How do you look for a black hole? Do you convert expansion variables into operators and test states with them? What do you do?
Okay. The question is, the questions of the classical model, do they admit black hole symmetry?
Yes, so there are at least in the Tolman-Lemaitre-Bondi models, yes, there are solutions in spherical symmetry. Yes. Then there's the questions about emergence of semi-classical gravity, Hawking radiation. I've already done some work with Tomasz Kozlowski on cosmology with dust time, and basically we reproduce precisely a lot of the results of this loop quantum cosmology program. So this has actually already been done. Nothing about fluctuations, though. And then you can ask, because it's in quantum gravity, what happens to Lorentz invariants? So that's that. How much time do I have?
No, 10 more minutes.
Oh, good. OK, so I want to talk about a couple of curiosities associated with different aspects of what I've talked about. So there's another use of this spin network Hilbert space that I described. And this is based on some old work that I did with Karl Tukács, something I call the SU2 theory. So think of this action. This action is, everything is SU2. It's not general relativity. It's a generally covariant theory. It's got a Dreibein in four dimensions. And it's got an SU2 spin connection. And you can add a Chern-Simons boundary term, if you like, to this. Should have put M and DM here. Or you can modify it in other ways. Now, the thing is that there's some length scale here. If you assign usual canonical dimensions to this, this is power counting non-renormalizable, just like GR is, because the connection has the usual dimension of connection. E is dimensionless, so just like GR. It has three local degrees of freedom, and this is a bit surprising. It's essentially because you have a degenerate metric in four dimensions. On the other hand, it has local degrees of freedom. The Hamiltonian constraint vanishes identically. If you do the canonical theory, you've got the spatial Diffeo constraint and the Gauss constraints only. Okay? There's nothing else to do. So therefore, this Hilbert space, which is the Hilbert space of the physical Hilbert space of this theory, is just this H-diff space. And now I don't even need to write any other operators because there isn't any other operators to write down. There's no Hamiltonian. I've got diffuse done, and that's it. So this provides an example of a perturbatively non-renormalizable four-dimensional theory with local degrees of freedom, albeit with no dynamics, which may have something to do with why we can do all this, which is completely quantizable in this framework. So a question I'll leave some people with here is, what is the corresponding spin foam for this model? There should be a very clean answer, and with full in the spin foam community, there's been various iterations of vertices that define the different spin foam models. Here, there should be a very clean answer to that question, and I haven't seen one. Maybe if somebody knows, they can tell me. Okay, that's one curiosity. So another curiosity is something which may be completely ridiculous, I don't know. You change the take the string action and just add this extra field to it, which is the dust field. It does a couple of things. It's no longer conformally invariant, so there I said the word conformal finally in this talk. Now I can look at the canonical theory of this in the big T equals little t gauge. Then the physical, you get a physical Hamiltonian and you get the spatial diffeomorphism constraint left. If you think of the usual canonical decomposition of this Polyakov action without this piece here, you know that it breaks down into just two copies of diff S1. You've got the LNs and the LN bars. Here with this, you have a different physical Hamiltonian. You've got full diff S1 you can impose freely because, you can because time is taken care of. There's manifest target space Poincaré invariance because you didn't touch the GAB at all when you do this. But then I don't know where this goes. It's just a little thought which you might want to consider. It's some kind of a non-critical string with an extra field. Do you have gravitons here? What does the closed string theory look like? And so on. So just a curiosity. And then second curiosity, which maybe I shouldn't have put in, but I just did this morning. There's little lambda. So once you're in the canonical theory, you can just stick the little lambda in by hand. You've still got a theory. And you can still write a physical Hamiltonian. Now you have a physical Hamiltonian with the little lambda. You can change the potential to some V of Q and see what happens. So because it's just a canonical theory, it's a canonical theory, which is how the Ojawa-Lifshitz action is written down too. This is written down in a slightly different way. There's a dust in the background. So anyway, I'll stop there.
Everything yes. seems to hinge on your dust.
Yes.
This crucial equation, uppercase T equals lowercase T. Could you just remind me exactly?
Uppercase T? Yes, okay.
Or
yes.
capital T.
I thought I was mixing T. indices. Yes. Yes, that's that time gauge, that yes. foliation.
Now, could you tell me again exactly what this is? Am I to think of dust carrying labels so that I can identify
yes.
it?
Yes.
And it's carrying something which tells, it's got a clock, and I can see if I was given a space like the slice, I could see a little bit of dust which would carry a label which would tell me what the dust is. That would be three labels to tell that, and it would be carrying a clock as well, or what?
I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means to carry a clock as well. It's just an ether, and the ether is time, and it's.
Where does the? First of all, I must identify the bit of dust. So I need three labels on it, three numbers on it to tell me which dust to take, correct or not?
Not three labels. It starts off being a field, so it's initially in the original action it's a function of t, x, y, z. When I fix
then
the time,
I would need to go to sort of some Kretschmann type things to be able to identify points in the thing.
I'm not identifying points. This is just time. So I'm just fixing time. So I'm not specifying space points at all. I still have the diffeomorphism space freedom.
So it has some value which is capital T. in this field? I mean, what is this field? It's just a scalar field.
It's just a special scalar field, a single scalar field.
I beg your pardon. So it's just a scalar field.
Yeah, it's not. I'm not using the term scalar field because it's a different action.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But it's just a scalar function. Which has a value. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Right.
And you go through the space-time manifold where you find that value.
Yes.
Okay,
yes, exactly right.
Sorry,
and no spatial coordinates are fixed in this. So if you like, this is pulling out Newtonian time for you, if you want to think about it that way.
Is it proper time along some geodesics?
It could be. I have to think about that.
My guess is on the calculations.
I mean, the metric is of the form minus dt squared plus. So so it looks like from just looking at the metric and the fact that n is 1, the answer could be yes, if I fix the dx intervals. But I'd have to do I have to set up something to actually answer that question.
I don't think it would be true to say it's Newtonian time, because Newtonian time is fairly distinguished.
I'm not thinking of, it's coming from a GR action, but the fact that it's now pulled out of the whole system, in that sense, it's not Newtonian time, strictly speaking, no. It's just pulled out in a
Am I right in thinking in one of Carol's papers related to the Brown dust, he talks about dust carrying a clock which measures proper time, which would relate to
I'd have to check that. It's certainly
sticks in my mind.
Yeah, it's not in the Brown Kukash paper.
I'm a bit suspicious about this because a little bit of dust isn't a clock.
I know that comment is not in the Brown Kukash paper
because
they're doing something different. So if it's in some other paper.
It's in one of Carol's papers, I believe.
Okay.
If my memory is not deceiving me.
Okay.
John, in the middle, we had the Hamiltonian constraint, which had to be effectively put to zero to limit the phase space. And you can do that by imposing the Lagrange multiplier to enforce that constraint. But then it appears that instead of doing that, you put in the gauge fixing first, like n equal 1 into the...
No, I deduced the n equals 1 for the metric. So the n equals 1 came from requiring that the gauge condition big T equals little t be preserved under time evolution. And so where I put it in is right here. So I have this action, which is pi q dot plus ptt dot minus n h gravity plus h dust plus the rest of it. Then I put big T equals little t, which means that this thing becomes 1. And at the same time, I solve the Hamiltonian constraint strongly for pt. Okay. So the n just disappears. So ag equals 0 strongly means pt is some function of the rest of the phase space variables. So then I simply have got 1 here. I stick this over here. This is all gone.
Right here.
Because I solve the Hamiltonian constraint strongly for PT and plug it back into the action to get the gauge fixed action. So this becomes 1, this becomes this, that's H physical. And this is gone because I solved it strongly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have two questions. In your curiosity number 1, you were saying you have propagating degrees of freedom with low dynamics.
Propagating, I didn't say propagating, I said local degrees of freedom.
Sorry.
Yes.
So
local degrees of freedom in terms of just counting.
What's the topic of degrees of freedom if they don't get
any? Well, they're just sitting there. It's as if I have, I solved the initial value problem for GR, and that is a solution, physical solution to the equations of motion. I don't need to solve any other equations of motion. So it's a very special theory. I say it has local degrees of freedom only because if I just do the first class constraint counting and the number of phase space variables, it's not a topological theory is what I want to say. Yeah.
My second question, how is this related to Jacobson's Einstein equation?
Ah, okay. So that's an interesting question. So Jacobson does not take a dust. He takes a vector field. And so he's got a kinetic term for the vector field and a constraint that the vector field is time-like. His vector field is not gradient of a scalar. And he's got a different kinetic, and he's also got a kinetic term which I don't have, separate kinetic term.
But if you impose the additional condition that the vector field be a gradient of the scalar,
If you do that, let me just think about that. So he's so his action is it certainly got this Lagrange multiplier times GAB UA UB plus one plus he's got a kinetic term for UA. So if I now state that UA is the gradient of a scalar, then I still have a kinetic term. And I have to deal with the kinetic term. And there's several other terms that he also considers at the same time. I don't know what they would look like.
I think the answer to that is essentially what Nyesh was doing in his paper. He showed the equivalence of Kirchhoff and Lifshitz and his Pascual at low energies. Because the kinetic term collapses down. Because you have four different kinetic terms. There's one reparametrization symmetry that Jacobson obviously uses to get rid of one of them. Then the other two vanish for gradients.
That may happen. I guess the...
Then the one that's left is, I think, precisely on-shell equivalent to what the AH was.
So how is this...
I don't know if that is, related to
that. So in a sense, I guess what I could say is if U is a gradient of a scalar, then the physical Hamiltonian for the dust will contain the part I had. It'll contain some more stuff. I don't know what that more stuff looks like, but that might be interesting. I mean, it could just be a special case of that. But then there's another term, and I don't know what the gauge fixing would do. Let me just think quickly. I mean, he's got some more terms here with various parameters that he tunes to get different kinds of ethers. But that's something I should look at.
Okay, so
I
have
to ask what sort of dust we have there. We've looked it up in those notes. It's a sort of dust that features in Stewart's Advanced General Relativity book. And it's supposedly a relatively recent thing, at least compared to when that book was written, which was, I guess, in the late 90s. And the main qualifying feature of it is that it's a time-like dust.
Yes, it's a time-like dust, yes. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Moreover, within the study of time-like dust, it is fairly standard then to take the U's to be gradients of them.
It's just that I don't know what the canonical
sort of matter rather than some strange sort of
From that point of view, it's established matter. Yes, I mean, we saw that from the TAB, that it's very established matter. Yes, and it's just that this is being put to a different use here. It's very old. As I said, it's in Lemaitre-Tolman-Bondi models as well.
It's not clear to me whether this sort of dust was available or not. This presentation of it was available during Marsden, Brown, and Kupesh themselves were solving dust systems.
They actually they were stuck with four scalar fields and a square root Hamiltonian. So it's mainly a classical paper that they had.
This may effectively represent progress in how dust is represented more widely in physics that allows you to move on from what they did. It could well be they didn't have that option.
Originally I started looking at this with the four scalar fields, and the problem occurred because I wanted to define the Hamiltonian, and you couldn't do it if you've got four scalar fields and it's fully deparametrized. Yeah, at least not in any simple way. You have to jump through hoops of all kinds that people like Jurek Lewandowski are doing to define a Hamiltonian with, say, four regular scalar fields, not a dust field. And you have to face the square root problem if you want to make progress.
Do you physically identify this dust with cosmological approximate dust, or is this dust some kind of intangible reference?
Well, I don't know how to think about that.
It appears in the diffeomorphism constraint, so it's presumably having a physical effect.
When I fix the gauge, the diffeo constraint collapses. Yes, because the contribution. Big T is little t, this vanishes. This is the decoupling of the Lapsin shift.
So it isn't really physical then?
Well, it's. I don't know the definition of physical. I mean.
Well, that you could, by making local measurements, you would say it must be there. I mean, they knew that Neptune was there because of the perturbation.
So if you're in this gauge, is that matter still out there? The answer is no. If you're in this gauge, the matter is gone. This dust matter is not there. It's somehow just provided a frame of reference, and you're just looking at everything else from the point of view of the dust flow lines.
So let's take one next question.
Okay, well, this is now two questions, but one of them maybe is short. There's an old hope, there was an old hope that the dependence of operators like the area operator on the inertia parameter just had to do with the fact that they were kinematical operators, and if you could somehow find the right dynamical operator, that would drop out. Can we say on the basis of that this model that hope is dead, and that different choices of inertia parameter now give you genuinely different operators?
Well, here what happens is now the physical Hamiltonian will contain the Immersi parameter.
Right.
So there's a one parameter family of physical Hamiltonians. Yes. And so it's actually there in, so if you could find the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, it would be there just like any other coupling constant.
Yeah, but I mean, the area, you said that, for instance, the area operator is now a physical operator.
Yes, it is.
So it's there.
It's there.
That's where it makes all the trouble.
Yes.
The other question, which I think may also be quick, which relates to this vast issue with Julian, if you look at classical solution of this theory, does the stress energy tensor of the dust appear and affect the metric? So can this dust, for example, collapse and form a black hole?
Okay, so suppose we look at it this way. If I'm in this time gauge and I switch off all the other matter, I've got three local degrees of freedom in gravity because I didn't use any of the gravity variables to fix the gauge. So that suppose I go to spherical symmetry, I can just collapse the geometric degrees of freedom in this model. So what is collapsing? Some kind of gravitons maybe are collapsing. I don't know what to call them. They're not quite gravitons because they're not perturbing on any background. So can this dust form black holes? I mean, the thing is, once I use it to fix the gauge and say it's gone out, it makes spherically symmetric gravity contain local degrees of freedom.
Okay, so you have things like the Lemaître-Tolman bonding collapsing.
In a sense, but disguised in terms of just the metric variables.
Right.
Yes, so I do have that, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the indirect test of this.
Yeah, so then it is there.
Yeah. It's there. From that point of view, it's there. I mean, I think from the point of view that I have an extra degree of freedom in the gravitational field, which is physical, because I'm not fixing a gauge using the geometric degrees of freedom. It's there. So it's manifesting itself in a different place. And it could be that, you know, if you do a linear analysis, there's a massive graviton. I don't know. It may have all kinds of other problems.
But do you know any solutions of this theory?
Sorry?
Do you know any non-trivial solutions of this
theory? So in spherical symmetry, we found some numerical solutions. Yes. I didn't show them here because I was still working on this. Yes. This is a precursor to the doing the quantum gravity of the spherically symmetric sector.
And this would be black hole-like?
They have horizons. We found a couple which were not asymptotically flat, which we didn't like. And so when you impose asymptotic flatness, we have something crazy going on we haven't sorted out yet. Okay. So maybe another time I can say something about that.
So yesterday I was very rude leaving a discussion because I was hungry. I see that people are getting hungry, or at least need coffee. Take a break here and come back in 15 minutes.